Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey, Joe.
Hey, Ollie.
How are you, buddy?
I'm good, buddy. How are you?
I'm good. You know, this could be theoretically the first time that any podcast listener is listening to the two of us together. Now, we have kind of another episode.
Little get to know you.
Little getting to know you.
Shorty in the front of it.
Our history. How in the hell is Oliver Hudson friends with Joe Buck and vice versa? So that's all there.
Mm-hmm.
But we just finished an interview with Bill Simmons, who is kind of the king of the podcast internet. He's got the Ringer
father,
the pod father. He's got
that's right.
You know, long time at ESPN. He's kind of made his own empire, and he's a guy that, frankly, back 10, 12 years ago, hated me. He hated me, and yet here he is, the first guest.
Yeah. Fascinating to hear you guys go back and forth. It was really, honestly, fun for me. I'm a big sports fan, obviously, and the first half of the interview, I was just an audience member. I was a fan listening to you guys with your vast sports knowledge go back and forth between the various sports and various games and the intricacies and the specifics of these games. It was it was like watching two encyclopedias talk, well, to Britannicas.
Well, here's the thing. He remembers a lot of that stuff way better than I do, because we're talking, when we talk with Bill, about a lot of New England stuff, whether it's the Patriots or the Red Sox or whatever. But these are things that are indelibly printed in his mind because he's a fan of Boston sports. I just, you know, I've called a lot of Boston sports nationally on Fox, and so that is where his dislike for me started, because when you do the national broadcast, you have to kind of tell all the backstory and the history and Bill Buckner, and it's been 86 years, and
Boston
fans are sick of that.
I know, but he gave such a great insight into why people might dislike you, okay? One that I've never heard before, and I don't want to reveal it in this lead up because I think just listen to it, but in the show, but it was very informative for me when he sort of explained why in, what was it, 04?
Yeah.
He was like, oh, he just did not like you.
03 and 04.
Because 03 and 04.
It was a great reason. Yeah, the Red Sox had a lead.
Yeah.
And then they blew it, and then they were getting trounced by the Yankees in 04, and then they came back, and so that's all history.
Yeah.
But now we've kind of come full circle. I don't know Bill that well. I got to know him on the podcast, which I think is going to be the fun part for you and me, and that is we're going to get to know people through this process that even though I've been around Bill, I didn't know 80% of what we just covered with him about his life.
I know.
Life.
And it was fun to talk to him about his father, you know, what he meant to him. There's an amazing article he wrote for ESPN Magazine, his last article he wrote for ESPN Magazine about his dad, which is very emotional and just beautifully written. You know, he's a big influence in his life. He seems to be a great father himself. You know, just an all-around great dude, really comfortable with who he is, super authentic. Do you think that he... When he hung up with us, do you think that he thought, oh, those guys did pretty good?
I think what I learned on that podcast,
it's more about us right now.
Is I'm going to put it into practice right now. I don't care what he thought about us when he hung up.
You're such a liar.
I don't care. I am comfortable in the job that we did. I am comfortable in the give and take, the back and forth, that if he didn't like it, so be it. I liked it.
Yes. And you know what? That's that's how Bill operates. If you don't like it, fuck off.
Right.
And so I'm going to operate along those lines. Bill, if you didn't like it, fuck off, baby.
Right.
Enjoy Bill Simmons. How you doing, man? How you doing in the times of the Q, the QT, the quarantine?
It's been really weird. My actual professional stuff hasn't changed that much because we're still like doing a bunch of podcasts. We're just doing a lot of them on Zoom and things like that and doing a lot of virtual stuff. But it's just weird not to go in the office and see people. And I've seen the same three people in my life for the last 2.5 weeks.
Who are they?
My two kids and my wife, and that's it. The FedEx guy came by yesterday. That was super exciting. I stayed 8 feet away from him.
do you wipe the boxes off?
Oh yeah, I picked up the boxes with paper towels and just, you know, these are just crazy times. I almost feel like this isn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is some alternate universe we've entered where I'm just afraid of everyone at all times, which is the complete opposite of how I used to be. I did a book tour, I think in 2009. And we would have like hundreds and hundreds of people at these things. I would shake hands with people. I would never even think to like wash my hands. Oh, I should bring Purell. I was just never that kind of person. And now I feel like I'm going to be terrified of everyone for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I feel like that's true. I feel like this is changing the landscape of what it is to be sort of sanitary. I'm a non-germ guy through and through. Like I eat shit off the floor. There is no 5-second rule. It's like a 5-minute rule for me and my kids, the same thing. But now I feel like I am going to be washing my hands. Every time I see someone shake a hand in a movie now, I get weird about it.
That's been weird, just watching movies and seeing how they're interacting in the movie and thinking, even when you see like people passing a bong in outside Providence or something, like, oh, there's a lot of germs in that bong. But it's changed everything. It's bizarre.
Hey, Bill, we call this thing daddy issues. You're our first guest for two reasons. One, you're kind of somebody's described you as the pod father. You're like the podcast king of all, not the Tiger King, but the podcast king of our lifetime.
I've never called myself that.
But let others do
it. Yeah. Thank you.
And we call it daddy's, but here's the other reason. We wanted to have Vetter on and you just had him, you fucker.
Yeah.
How was that, by the way?
You know, I was supposed to go to Seattle and do it with him and Jeff Ament, and the Corona thing changed everything, and we ended up having to do it three people, three locations, on the phone, no Zoom, couldn't see anybody. So the ceiling just automatically lowers. It's really hard to do a pod when it's three people and nobody could see each other, and you're basically doing these little cues, which Joe knows as a longtime established, accomplished host, where you're basically cueing the person to talk, where you're like, blah, 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 blah. Isn't that right, Joe?
Yeah.
And we went for like 2.5 hours. And by the second half of it, they kind of figured out how to do it. So the second half was really good. And Eddie's like lighting up spirits during it.
Of course.
Asked for a beer at one point. I tried to wrap it up a couple times. And and he just wanted to keep going. But I the funniest thing he said was basically that when the Jordan, he was a huge Jordan Bulls guy. And then when the Jordan thing ended, he basically just quit basketball. He retired with Jordan, and that was it. He was done with basketball. And I think he's kind of like that now with the Cubs too, where they won the title and he feels like that was it. I've climbed.
Are you there at all with the Red Sox? I mean, I look back during this whole quarantine time and I go back and I watch some of the old stuff, and sometimes you can't even miss it. It's coming across MLB Network, or somebody sends you an email, or somebody tweets something at you. And you go back and you watch that and you go, man, it just had such a different feel than it does now. And I didn't grow up, obviously, like you did. We are basically the same age. But you grew up as a longtime Boston fan, Red Sox, all the heartbreak. And then they win. And then they win again. And then they win again. And then they win again. And I look back at 04 and I go, God, it just feels like an entirely different lifetime in the sport of baseball. Do you feel that way?
Oliver, so you know I really hated Joe in 03-04. Yeah. But I hated all these people that the Red Sox fans were like,
Why did you hate Joe? Because this has been a topic of conversation with Joe and I forever and ever. Why everyone hates Joe?
This is different.
Okay.
This is different. He was just one of the many people who did this. And I don't blame him for it because you're a host, you're hosting a game, you're trying to make it appealing to all the different audiences. The Red Sox were basically baseball lepers. And anytime anything good was happening for us in any way, shape, or form, it was like the Fox producers would be like, hey, the Red Sox fans are feeling good right now. They have a 2-run lead. Let's run the Buckner montage. And it was over and over again. Anytime you're feeling good about anything, it was a kick in the balls over and over again. Even when Game 7, Yankee Stadium, we're up by like 7 runs, and Joe's like, I know they're up by 7 runs, but when you think about the history of these two teams, and we're like, shut up, Joe! Let us enjoy this!
That's so fair.
He was doing his job. But if you watch that last inning, I think, of Game 7 in Yankee Stadium, they couldn't resist. They ran the Boone homer again.
Yeah.
And they were like, hey, just don't ever feel safe. So by the time we actually won, it felt like we had escaped a prison in Vietnam in like 1974 or something. Like we were escaping with Chuck Norris getting to safety. And that was the best thing. So to answer your question, Joe, the best thing about winning was just not having to think about the 86 years anymore and not having that stuff thrown in our face. And Bucky Dent and Ed Armbrister and Aaron Boone and all these terrible things that had happened over the years, they just kind of vanished. So anything after that was gravy.
I get it.
My in-laws are all from Boston, all of them. So my wife is from Boston. Everyone, we go to the Cape every year, and they're obviously diehard sports fans. The Lakers, I'm a Lakers fan, I know you hate the Lakers, but when the Celtics beat the Lakers, I show up for the summer, you know, and Brooks Botlett, her dad, shows up to pick me up from the airport in a full Celtics uniform. And the guy's like 68 years old. Full head to toe, shoes, shorts. You know, it's pretty fantastic.
There is something different about the Red Sox fan or the Celtics fan or the Bruins fan. I live in St. Louis, and they're all the nicest fans in the big leagues. And I think to some degree, that's really accurate. And I go up to the Northeast and I've been involved in some of these Yankee Red Sox battles. And there's an edge to it that was there during those years that I don't know, maybe it's because I'm desensitized, but I don't feel like that's there anymore. Do you feel that way? Or am I missing that?
No, because we're the same age. When I was growing up, they won the one game playoff against us in 78. And that was like one of the most traumatic events of my life. And then you go through the 80s, they're not really playing each other. They're peaking at different times. The 90s happen. All of a sudden, when that Yankee dynasty started again, that's when the Red Sox got good again too. And now we're going head to head again, but they're beating us. And it's at the point where we're not even like the little brother in the relationship. We're just the tiny guy at the bar who's getting the crap kicked out of us every night, and we have no chance. And they're so arrogant. So you go the 03 when we blew the lead and Grady Little and all that stuff, and the Boone thing hits. I was so upset. I was working for Jimmy Kimmel's show at the time, and I stayed up really late that night. I wrote a piece about how upset I was, basically. And then the next day I went to work. And I actually asked to leave at like 2:30. I was so, so upset. I couldn't work. I had to like just go home and like and take the dogs for like a 2-hour walk and just kind of think about, why do I care this much? You know, that point, I'm in my mid-30s. It's like, why do I care this much?
I was just going to ask that question, actually. Where do you think that comes from? The fanaticism of sports? You know, how you especially just live and die with
with your teams.
Right.
Why do you think that these fanatics, assume the identity of their teams? What does that come from? You know what I mean? Where you literally live and die with your team. Like, what is that?
I think part of it is the cold weather thing. I think the cold weather cities, you look at Philly and New York and Chicago, mm-hmm. and these places where the weather just sucks for 4 or 5 months a year and sports just takes on a greater importance. Like, if you're like, I moved to LA in 2002, and they really care about the Lakers and the Dodgers specifically, and the college stuff to a lesser degree. But there's also way more things to do here, and the weather's nicer, and it's just more pleasant mm-hmm, here. Mm-hmm. You know, the St. Louis people, the people in the Midwest, you know, the weather is not fantastic there either, but they're just nicer people. Mm-hmm. East Coasters, cold weather, we're kind of in each other's face all the time. We're up and down, more passionate just about everything for better and worse. And I think the sports ties into that. But the weird thing with the Red Sox and all the Boston stuff was things really flipped this century. And we kind of became America's villain, which we went from being like the same way people would see the Browns fans now. And like, that's what the Patriots were like when the Patriots were basically the Browns for the mm-hmm. first 30 plus years of my life. The Red Sox were the baseball team that was the Red Sox and the Cubs were the two sad sacks. So the reason like somebody like Joe was like the doctor who was delivering bad news to me about my family member for years in a row. I just saw his face. I'm like, I just associate him with bad things.
I get it.
And it's not Joe's fault at all, but he knew it, but it wasn't your fault.
No, and I know, and that's what I get from every fucking fan base out there. So not only am I, in your specific case, attached to all this, you know, angst and at times failure, and it didn't change until 04, but I'm also screaming for the team that just won it. So it's almost double. Not only do you have to see my face and my gigantic head, but you have to listen to me get excited, which you don't all year. So you're watching Nesson, or you're watching in New York, you're watching Yes or whatever. And it's state-run TV. It's, you know, we're the best, we're the best. Yay, we just hit a home run. Boo, the other team just hit a home run. And then I show up when you care the most, and I'm not only did you lose, but I'm screaming and yelling because another team just beat you. It's only natural. But that's just kind of the life that I have to. It's either that or don't do it. I mean, there's just no.
Well,
there's no way around that.
The fans are also irrational, though. Like, one of my best friends in the world, John O'Connell, my friend Jacko, huge Yankee fan. He's been on my podcast a bunch of times. He's honestly, genuinely convinced that John Smoltz hates the Yankees. And when he watches Yankee playoff games, every time Smoltz says anything, it's like, oh, you can hear it in his voice. He's just happier when it's going badly for the Yankees. I can tell. And this is a normal person with two kids and a job and really genuinely feels that way. I don't even know how you stop.
Before we get to you, and that's the main part, that's the reason why we wanted you on, I'm just going to reveal something on my own new podcast, you being our first guest. Here's how I think. Yankees, when they're good, everybody's happy. Red Sox, when they're good, everybody at Fox, therefore we're all happy. Cubs, same thing. Dodgers, same thing. These are all fan bases that think I don't root for them or hate them or I root against them. I would be literally cutting off my own paycheck, in essence, or the happiness with my network if I rooted against these teams. Now, when the Red Sox and Yankees play, I don't care who wins. I didn't grow up in that. So I get excited for a big play, that's it. But the big market teams, those are the ones that at the end of the day you want in the biggest games. And so if anything, I'm more leaning toward the Red Sox at times or toward the Yankees, depending on who they're playing. When they play each other, I don't give a shit. So that's kind of how
it is. But are you complicit in the Astros cheating because you did hear the banging from up in the booth?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I was aware.
Joe knew about it. Joe buried some shit.
Joe buried some shit for sure.
Uh-huh.
You know the Fox people knew about it. They had to.
Our audio guy So when this thing broke, I did not. I swear to God on my children's lives, I did not know. But our audio guy was like, we knew something was going on because we've got microphones everywhere. So there's a guy at a mixing table, in essence, in the truck that has microphones in the bases, in the dugout, in the booth, in the outfield wall. They hear all that stuff. He's like, oh, yeah, we heard that banging going on all the time. So I think if he was aware, I think a lot of people were aware, and it just broke. It became public. And if the Astros are doing it, I am really hard-pressed to believe other teams and other organizations that all think they're smarter than every other team out there, all 29 other teams, aren't doing some version of that. I don't know what it is, but some version of that is happening in every organization, I'm convinced. I just don't see how that's with player movement and somebody being in the bullpen for the Astros one day and getting cut, and the next day they're with the Rangers, and they don't know that's going on with their own hitters, and they don't tell their own pitchers that that's going on. That's absurd. That there's no way that everybody in the game is not doing something like that. Do you agree with that, Bill?
Well, and I think that's why they didn't vacate the title and any of that stuff. Because, like, really what they should have done is what the NCAA does, where they're like, look, it happened. We're not changing who won it, but we're not recognizing that title anymore. I think so many people were doing so many different things related to sign stealing that they couldn't single the Astros. The Astros were just the most blatant and stupidest, but I'm sure all these teams are. And I think the same thing in football. You watch the coaches and they're calling in plays and they're covering their face with the play chart. It's because people are stealing signs from them, which is technically you're not allowed to do, but everybody does it. So right. I don't know where you draw the line. I just think the Astros were the stupidest version of it.
Yeah, I don't mm-hmm. disagree with that. I really want to talk about you specifically, Bill, because I know you've been what?
Yeah, no. I just want to talk about that the fanaticism real quick, and if you think that's a generational thing. I mean, do you think that, you know, that comes from your father or even your mother? You know, where you grew up watching these sports and trying to emulate your father? You know what I mean?
Well, how old are you, Ollie?
I'm 43.
Yeah, you're a tiny bit younger than Joe and I. Our generation, we just had less to do. Mm-hmm. So when I was like, 76 to 80, really getting into stuff, we had the three cable channels. I don't think we had video games yet. We had no internet. We didn't have on-demand VCRs, any of that stuff. So sports was a huge thing. So like the 76 Olympics, that was 2.5 weeks of like stuff to watch. Yeah. And I watched everything. And I think our generation just watched more of that stuff. I look at the generation, my kids are 14 and 12 and they just have so many more entertainment options. Mm-hmm. My son he'll watch like the big Pats games with me, but he's seen more of the Pats just from like YouTube mm-hmm. and from like the greatest play montages.
Are your
stuff
kids
like that.
Big sports fans?
Not like that, no. I mean, they know what's going on, but he knows most of the guys from the video games.
Right.
You know, from 2K and from the show and from Madden. So he knows all the guys from that. But yesterday, my son and I were watching the Pats Falcons Super Bowl that Joe was lucky enough to call.
That's right. Did you think I was rooting against your fucking team then?
No, you know what you were doing? You were bowing to the altar of the great one, Tom Brady, which that was like his ultimate. Even after he's getting congratulated and people are coming up to him like he's the Dalai Lama or something. Yeah. The way people are hugging him and that game was, I still think that's the most incredible football game I've ever seen. Mm. I cannot believe they won that game. And when you rewatch it, all the different ways
Amazing.
The Falcons could have won. There's like 15 plays where if the Falcons just do the right thing on one play, they win the
how
game.
About if
and they go
how about 15. After they complete that ball to Julio Jones, they could have literally taken a knee.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, nobody's going to do that. But they could have taken a knee almost the rest of the game if they make a field goal at the end after that Julio Jones. There's no way. There's not enough time left for New England to come back and tie it. But once they got what Troy and I think we're proud of in that game as announcers of being there is we didn't quit on it. And I think we didn't quit on it because it was Brady. If it was anybody else, you would have just tapped out and you start talking about everything else. And then all of a sudden you get surprised because now it's a one score game, but it was Brady. It was like, well, you never know. I mean, it is Brady.
Right.
And then stuff started just rolling. And there are, as you said, I mean, there's like literally 10 things that if those 10 things don't happen the way they happen and it goes, any one of those 10 goes the other way, they don't have time to come back and tie the game. It just was amazing that that happened in the Super Bowl.
It's very similar to Game 6, 86. Even though that was more condensed with all the ways the Red Sox blew that game, it has the same elements of just the staggering amount of plays that if one of them swings the other way, the Patriots lose, the Mets lose. And that's it.
Yep.
I think it's the greatest collapse in a sporting event I think that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's impossible to lose that game. Mm-hmm. If you played it 100 times, I don't think the Falcons maybe win 98 of
there's
them.
Three.
So when you talk about... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, there's three games that I've done personally that fall into that category. That Patriots Super Bowl, the NFC Championship game with the Packers and the Seahawks.
Oh, Seahawks. Yeah.
That's another one where it's like... Literally, pestilence and locusts were the only things missing from the collapse and how the Seahawks ended up going to the Super Bowl. That was another, I mean, just run of things that happened that just doomed Green Bay. That if any one of the things went the other way,
right?
And then the Cardinal fans still talk about 2011 Game 6 and the Cardinals being down literally to their last strike. Twice and tying it in the ninth, tying it in the 10th, winning it in the 11th, and Cruz and Wright not being deep enough. I mean, just little thing. That's the beauty of sports and why I think analytics works to a certain degree, but then it's up to, you know, who's going to get a break? Who's going to get something that goes against the analytics? Who's going to play too shallow and right? Who's not going to catch an onside kick that goes right to his chest? You know, these are things that numbers and mathematicians cannot account for in sports.
Well, what is baseball managers these days, right? Are they actually managing the team from the bench or are they managing it from upstairs these days? I mean, is there any feel to the sport anymore in baseball or is it all math?
I think most of the issues right now with managers and front offices are usually the front office overpowering the manager with information and the gut feeling aspect of it kind of going away, which makes sense and also doesn't make sense because sometimes things defy imagination. I think, you know, sometimes you got to wonder if things are predetermined and shit like that. Like to me, in 2016, Game 7, the rain delay, the timing of it, where the Cubs had just blown it and in any other scenario, they just lose the game. It's going to happen. They're going to lose. And this rain delay pops out of nowhere and kind of resets the game. And then they end up winning it. But just the fact that it rained then, out of all the times it could have rained, and that they, just when they needed the life raft the most, I think about that. I think about like a game Joe did, game four, I think it was game five, Red Sox Yankees, Tony Clark hits this seed down the right field line. And it bounces over the fence, and it's a ground rule double. It keeps the runners at second and third. And it's like, I've been watching Red Sox games my entire life. The odds of that ball, the way he hit it, actually just skipping and going over the fence versus hitting the fence, it's like 1 in 20. And stuff like that happens, and you're like, oh, maybe we were destined to win this. So
do you,
I don't know.
Do you Sports believe in that stuff? This stuff? Are you superstitious? You're like a superstitious person.
In 04, I wore the same Red Sox t-shirt every day for like, I think 3 weeks. So, or 03, one of those years. Yeah, so I have like seating positions, the Falcons-Pats Super Bowl. We were watching at home. We all switched seats at halftime. We stayed in the seats. I totally believe in all that stuff. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. But hey, it's like blaming the announcer if they mention a no-hitter and then the no-hitter goes away. Some of that stuff is just crazy, but it adds to the fun of it and it makes you feel involved. If you feel like, hey, if I sit in the Lazy Boy for the next 10 minutes and they score two touchdowns, I'm not getting out of the Lazy Boy. And you feel like you're a part of the whole process, which is just kind of silly.
Joe, you've ruined a lot of no hitters. Let's be honest.
No, I have intentionally.
You've intentionally jinxed about 20 of them. I think
absolutely. You know, I don't think I've ever called a no hitter. So maybe you're right.
We talked about this before, but I never fully understood what Joe's life was like until I was doing NBA Countdown for ABC and ESPN during the 2013 finals, and it was Miami San Antonio, and both fan bases thought I hated them.
Right.
And it was like, so I'm rooting for basically a nuclear war. What am I rooting? So I'm not rooting for Miami because I hate them, and I also hate San Antonio. So there's no other side. I can't be on a side.
Did that bother
point.
You at all? Did it affect?
Yeah.
Did it, okay, good. Did it affect what you said going forward once you were aware of that?
No. I was more amused by it because honestly, I didn't care who won. You know, I remember during game six, the Ray Allen shot, we had been on the road for 2 weeks. And I remember with like a minute left, hoping San Antonio would win because I would get to go home and see my kids. But, you know, it wasn't like I was on the air rooting for that. But I do remember having that feeling like, oh, I hope San Antonio wins. I'm just dying to go home.
We just talked about that, Joe. I forget what you were calling. I think it was the World Series, this last World Series, and we were on the phone, and you know, and he said the same shit. He's like, I just end this thing. I want to go home. I want to go see my family.
I just want to go home. I remember, yeah, at the end of a long month and, you know, whatever. It's impossible to take your personal feelings out of it. Along those lines, but it doesn't bother you, Bill, if you're sitting in a you know, you guys do some of those on the location sets. If somebody's out there riding your ass, like fuck you, Simmons, fuck you, hate the Spurs, fuck you, that stuff, you giggle at that? Or
I've always found that if you just engage with the people, and I remember this in San Antonio, we kind of won over the San Antonio people around us during those two finals. We're just engaging with them and having fun with it versus kind of glancing over nervously or whatever. Like I think when you engage with the people, it makes that stuff a lot easier.
Yeah, but that's what I try to tell Joe, you know, because he gets super insecure about it, you know, and I'm just like, Joseph, lean into it. We literally had this conversation yesterday. His wife, Michelle, was like, don't talk about this hating Joe all the time. It's bad energy. And I'm like, you got to lean into that stuff. That could be your calling card. Like, fucking go with it. Don't rail against it.
Well, that was Joe, like, I'm going to say like 4 or 5 years ago, made a really smart career move just talking honestly and openly about all this stuff, about what it's like to be the America's announcer for these different things. And you kind of swayed the internet back on your side. It was interesting to watch. Now I feel like people love Joe now. I definitely don't feel like that was the case in the mid-2000s. And there was definitely a Summerall hangover. People loved Madden and Summerall. That took a while to any other football crew they weren't going to totally accept. But now I think there's like a real appreciation. It especially helps. I won't mention other telecasts that maybe haven't worked as well, like Monday Night Football. Yeah. but when the broadcast teams don't work, I think it makes people really appreciate like Joe and Troy and Al and Chris and Nance and Romo, especially lately, because Nance and Sims had a really rough last couple years, and now Nance and Romo, and all of a sudden people are like, oh, Jim Nance is great. It's like Jim Nance has always been great.
Yeah.
Like he didn't just get better at age 62. Like he's been good the whole time.
No, you're bringing up a lot of stuff that you know I could talk to you for days, and we won't keep you we won't keep you for one full day. I could, but I want to talk about you because I feel like what has been so appealing about you is you've been willing, Bill, to open yourself up and be literally like an open book. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't know if that was a conscious decision. I don't know. I just feel like you are as honest about yourself and who you are in your writing, in your television appearances, whether it's back at ESPN or for the time at HBO or what you do anywhere. I feel like you're kind of what you see is what you get. And I think I've taken some of that on myself. I think I've learned from you in that way. Was that a decision you made, or is that just the only way you know how to be?
I think I probably two things. One is I think you have to be authentic, especially in the social media internet era, or people see right through it. And if you're not honest about things you've done that have either worked or not worked, it just rings hollow. And if you don't stay true to what you actually are like, people are going to notice. And then the other thing is just like, I've just never been afraid to fuck up or to have some sort of failure, you know, like the HBO show, both of the HBO shows we did, neither of them worked. It's okay. Like, I guarantee you learned a bunch of stuff from the experience you had. I know I learned a bunch of experience from mine, but my instinct has always been to do it versus talk yourself out of doing it. Like, even ending up on Countdown when I did, I look back at that. That was kind of crazy. I'd been on TV like 20 times and did not have the reps really at all. We didn't have a host. And I was like, fuck it. I know the NBA. I can do this. And it probably took like 5-6 months to get really where I kind of needed to be on that show. But it was like, I'm really glad I tried. So my feeling has always been, go for it versus talk yourself out of it. And if the worst thing that happens, it doesn't work, then take the lessons that you got from it and move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have any regrets about being as authentic and open and honest, you know, as you are? You're like, fuck it, no regrets. This is just who I am.
I have regrets from stuff I wrote in the 90s and the 2000s where I look back and I think it was almost too harsh. And, you know, and I think part of that was just a product of what the internet was like back then. It was still kind of forming into what it was. And, you know, my attitude back then was like, I'm going to say exactly what I think about all this stuff. And I think what I failed to realize probably until the mid late 2000s is once you have a platform that's a certain size, you can't just be winging it and throwing grenades and taking shots left and right, even if sometimes you want to, because, you know, a lot of people are reading it. Some of that stuff can be hurtful. So I look back at some of the stuff I've written, and I was like, man, I can't believe I wrote that. I shouldn't have written that. I should have thought about, you know, what the other person is like. But, you know, sometimes you don't realize that stuff until you hit a level for yourself where people are lobbing grenades at you. And now you know it. Now you're on the other side of it. Now you know what that feels like. And it kind of makes you realize, like, all right, what's worth it and not worth it about how honest you want to be about something.
What's a criticism of you that gets under your skin? What's a criticism of you that you may think is valid, that you get a lot, that you've worked on regarding your own presentation or your own writing or whatever it may be?
I'm going to flip that question around. The thing you realize is, and at some point in your career, if you're successful, you're just going to realize it, is that everybody gets picked apart. You know, nobody has a 100% approval rating that has an audience of a certain size, you know, and what you do with that information, you can either double down on the stuff you're doing and say, fuck it, half the people are going to be against me. And I think we've seen some people, especially in sports media, who have operated that way. You could take some of it to heart. You could try to whittle away some of the stickier stuff, or you know, I think ultimately a lot of times criticism makes people better. It makes you more resilient and makes you realize the stuff you're doing that isn't working. And I think sometimes you know, I think you see it especially with older people who are really successful, who are just kind of like, hey man, this, I'm gonna dance with what brought me, and say, you can't really do that. But for criticisms that I think most more recent ones, you know, I don't write anymore. So when somebody brings that up, like it first of all, it hits close to home because I'm a writer and that's how I became anything. And I just feel like I've kind of said everything I had to say from a writing standpoint. So when people bring up like, well, you're not a writer, you don't write anymore, you're retired. And I'm like, ah, shit, that's kind of true. Like, so that one hurts because I still feel like I'm going to write again. But now the years are passing, and I'm like, I haven't written anything in 3 years.
Well, by the way, I read the piece that you did on your dad last night, which was awesome, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that was really emotional. It was just awesome, you know? And, you know, I wish I could write something like that about my dad, but I don't really know him. So
thank you.
Way to bring it down.
Sorry. But was your dad a big influence in your life? I mean, even as a kid growing up? Yeah. He was the man. You even after the divorce, like, how did that work out, by the way? You know what I mean? Like, were you on and off between mom and dad?
Yeah. So when my parents got divorced, it was probably the worst possible time. I was 9. So you're like just smart enough to know what's going on, but dumb enough to think like it was all your fault. and they got divorced. I had this stretch where the Red Sox lost the one game playoff to the Yankees. My parents separated, and then the Bruins lost the too many men in the ice game to the Canadians. And I was like a wreck after that. Then Larry Bird showed up and it was fine. But
I'm not going to ask you to rank which one hurt the most.
Oh, the one game playoff is number one. That was because we blew a 14.5 game lead over the last 10 weeks of the season, and that culminating in clawing back to get this one game playoff and then the whole thing. But with my dad, he used to carry me into the Boston Garden until I was 10. We had one season ticket, and then eventually he got a second one. But I was able to go to just some incredible Celtic, pretty much all the vintage Bird era games. And wow. I think that's why I like sports, because of all those experiences.
Yeah. Your dad is the one who sort of, I'm sure, introduced you to that entire world, right? I mean,
yeah. Cause we're watching Pats on Sunday. We're watching Red Sox every day. And you know, there was a lot less going on. It's funny. My dad, I think they have a Celtics season ticket list of who's had him the longest, who still is actually going, versus people who passed him down. He's like 7th on the list now for the Celtics.
Oh my God.
7th. Wow. 7th longest Celtics season ticket holder. But when he got him, he was like 25 and he got one ticket, and it was the first year he got tickets, they won the title. So I think when you have something like that happen, there's no way you're not going to love sports. I'm sure the same thing with Joe, like his dad's calling the games. Like I you know, when you're a little kid, you get swept up in that and there's no going back.
We talked about that, you know. Well, Joe wrote about it, you know, obviously in his book, but you know, similar. I mean, I'm in the movie television business. I don't really know anything else. I grew up on sets with my parents. That's where I was from the age of infant till, you know, now. I don't know what else I would do. You know, we're pretty much a product of our parents to some extent, you know, unless we're railing against them. Do your kids want to get into what you do?
No, but my daughter really wants to. My daughter, I've had her on a podcast a bunch of times, and she's really good at like teen culture stuff. She's just good at it, and I don't really have an explanation for it. Yeah. And she always jokes about wanting to do it when she gets older. But you know, my whole thing is like 10 years from now, who the fuck knows what's going to. Like maybe podcasts are out and we're on to whatever the next thing is. You think about how fast everything moves. Like when we created Grantland in 2011, we created the site for people on their desktop. And right after the site launched, the iPad came out. And then the iPhones really took off a year later. And now everybody's reading stuff on their phones. Now you think 2020, everyone reads everything on their phones. Nobody really reads on a computer anymore. I don't know how things are going to evolve over the next 10 years from a media standpoint. I think what's been really fascinating about this Corona thing, is how it's kind of changed our habits on the fly with certain things. And I know things will go back to normal in some ways, but in other ways, no. And we were talking on my podcast last week with sports media. As it turns out, you can kind of just have shows, even if the people aren't on the fancy set together. And you could do split screen stuff and you can get creative and you can think outside the box. And I do think there's going to be lessons when all this settles down, thank God, for how they do shows going forward. Maybe 4 people don't need to be together all the time. Mm-hmm. Maybe like a show like Kimmel's show, he can do like more FaceTime stuff with guests for 4 minutes.
Totally on the table. I agree, man. I mean, you even look at all these live things that are happening right now, these live DJ sessions, which are amazing, you know, and how we are adapting to the new, you know, which, well, look at even Stern. I'm a huge Howard Stern fan. You know, he is still doing his show from his house. It's totally shitty. You know, it goes in and out with sound. But there's something almost nice about it in a strange way. You know, I like the authenticity of him even being at his house. You know, so I think you're right. You know, it's interesting too, just on another level. You were talking earlier just sort of about the coronavirus in general and how weird it feels or how weird it is, right? I was talking to my kids yesterday, and we are so adaptable as a species. You know, it is weird, but at the same time, 2 weeks in, 3 weeks in, there is a normalcy that we are all sort of, you know, adapting to. It's, I'm not afraid on the day to day. You know, it's like, okay, this is just what we have to do. This is just who we have to be now. And it's an interesting time, you know, for that and how to move forward, especially in the entertainment business.
Well, the entertainment business, I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's going to have trouble coming back. And I think just the production schedule of shows and movies, like I had two different documentary projects that are basically pause buttoned right now. Mm-hmm. There's some stuff that's going to take a while to come back. And even like you think about sports, and I'm like a generally glass half full kind of person thinking about, all right, if we can get through this, this is going to be an unbelievable 6 months of sports. From July on, where we'll have a condensed baseball schedule, we'll have football, we'll have basketball playoffs and four majors and all these things. But at the same time, like, it's going to be a lot of content at once. And from a crowd standpoint, I don't know how many people are even going to want to be going. Like, let's say the NBA comes back in July. Am I going to want to sit in the stands at that point, even if they're telling me it's fine? Mm-hmm. Am I going to want to do that? So I think things will get back to normal, but the arc of it, I think, will probably be a little more haphazard than maybe we think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, well, first of all, I mean, we can go in a lot of different directions. I agree with you. I'm starting to think, Bill, that we're going to have a much more difficult time getting back to normal in professional sports.
I think baseball is in a lot of trouble this season because I don't think it's realistic it comes back before July. But if it comes back, you're still going to need a month-long. It's not like basketball where these guys can basically stay in shape and get back out there after a couple practices. Baseball, you need a few weeks, especially with the pitchers and the timing and all that stuff. So now you're talking, let's say best case scenario, it's July 1st, but it's not really July 1st. It would be like July 20th, July 21st, where they're actually playing. So now you're talking about like a 70-game season in playoffs. You can't really take the baseball playoffs into November. So I would say out of all the ones that are in trouble, I think baseball is actually number one. Basketball, they can figure out some sort of playoff, six-week playoff thing in July, August. Football, you know football's happening.
Yeah.
They're plowing ahead no matter what the obstacles are. Even you saw it this week. Goodell's like, yeah, we're still having the draft. It's happening April 23rd and 25th. All these teams are saying, we'd kind of like to interview the players that we might have to be drafting. He's like, we're doing it. I think football will plow ahead, and I think college football will too. But baseball is the one that I really can't wrap my head around how they would actually do it. Now, I'm hoping it happens because I think we're going to learn some stuff about things we thought about the different sports. Like with baseball, maybe it should be a 120-game season with longer playoffs. And maybe we'll really like how the regular season turns out. Maybe we'll like a shorter basketball season. Maybe we'll like if the basketball playoffs are July and August and, you know, the finals are the last 2 weeks of August. Maybe that makes more sense. They don't have to go against football at all. So I do think we're going to learn some stuff, but for fans actually going back to the games and wanting to be in crowds, I think that's going to take more time than people are giving it credit for.
Yeah,
So we call this podcast Daddy Issues, and I know I'm jumping tracks here, but I do want to get back to this. And you're our first guest, so you're the guinea pig. But we do, because Oliver is following his mom and in some ways his sister, his brother, his stepdad, whatever. I'm following my dad into this business. But I in that article that Oliver just referenced about you and your last column that you wrote for ESPN, the magazine, as you were making your exit and your dad was exiting his 33-year career as a school superintendent, there was a sentence in there that caught my attention because it's something that I have always said about my dad, and you said, he's my best friend. I have not run across a lot of men our age or in that age bracket where I see them admit that their dad was their best friend. I think it's beautiful. I think he obviously brought you into sports, but there's so much more there, whether it's your education, whether it's your ability, I think, Bill, as an educator, and the way you find talent and the way you teach and the way you're bringing people into the ringer and the way you have kind of passed things down. I think that is the essence of Bill Simmons that not a lot of people understand. And I think it's so, I don't want to say it's rare, but the picture that you have in there of your arm around your dad at, I don't know what it is, a Super Bowl, I guess it is, is...
No, you know what Super Bowl that was? That was the Giants, the 07, the 19-0 game.
Oh, my God.
My dad, it was his 60th birthday, and for his present, we went to the Super Bowl, and we were going to watch the Pats go 19-0. So we took that picture right before the drive that had the Tyree catch.
I remember that one. I was there.
You did that game,
I did,
right?
That game, yeah.
Yeah, because I was there. I've never watched it since. That's one of the few games that I don't think I've put on since that happened.
I just love the reverence you have for your father's career. And I wonder that as you compare yourself, maybe you do, maybe you don't, but as you compare yourself to your dad, I feel like the way you think and the way you talk about your dad, I feel like you hold him up like, man, this is a guy who worked his ass off. This is a guy who gave everything he had every day. And I would imagine that drives you to do all these different things that you're doing.
So when I wrote that column, it was 2009. And at that point, you know, I was having a lot of success at ESPN with the column. We had 30 for 30 coming up and all that stuff. And I just thought it was interesting because I didn't feel like I was any different than I was 13 years before when I'm just like a bartender and I have no idea what I'm going to do with my life. The stuff that happened with my dad where he put that many years into the same school system and really had an effect on these people in this town east of Massachusetts. And he meant a lot to this one place and that was it. But that, to me, that mattered as much as the stuff I was doing. And, you know, I think going forward from 09 on, especially with the 30 for 30 experience I had, when you're writing stuff, you're by yourself and it sucks. And I think that's the number one reason people don't like writing. It's a whole process. It starts, you turn your computer on, you're staring at an empty Microsoft Word document or whatever you're writing on, and you got to do it. And it's just you. And I think the 30 for 30 experience I had where it was so collaborative, and it was me and Connor Schell, who now runs ESPN. And we really, it was the two of us figured out that whole series over like a 10-month span. Everyone left us alone. And then we added other people to our team who were able to do it. And some of the people that were on that team have gone on to do really cool stuff. Like Dan Silver's running one of the divisions for Disney Plus. Libby Geist, who is on our team, she runs ESPN Films now.
Yeah, yeah. I just interviewed Willie and Libby because I have a podcast with my sister. We did Libby and Willie. Libby's awesome.
Yeah, Libby's great. Yeah. So just that whole thing made me think, all right, this was cool. How do I do this with, could I do this with a website? What is the website I've always wanted to read? And could we find young talent? And that's been something that the last 10 years has... I've really taken a lot of satisfaction over, like finding people that I thought were good or young people that had a chance. Now on the Ringer side now, because I have such a good inner circle now. We could bring young people into that and really, really, if it's somebody who's talented and driven, we can really push them up a level, I feel like. And that took like about a decade to figure out. So, you know, I think if you can, if you're ending your career and you can look back and think that you pushed a lot of people in the right direction, however many people that was, that's probably the best thing you can do. The other stuff is like, that's going to come and go. Mm-hmm. You know, but if you've affected somebody else's life, not to sound all sappy, but that's always going to last longer than some column.
Yeah, you built mm-hmm. something, like your father built something and wanted to see it to its finish. And you know, I you know, not to be corny too, but you know, you list his top two things that he built. I would say built you too. And you're shooting off this branch of his tree and now building something of your own. I just think it's a beautiful story.
Do you have a strong work ethic? Are you like are you a big put your nose to the grindstone guy?
I do have a good work ethic. The funny thing is I didn't in the past. Mm-hmm. And I always look back at
I'm still trying to like find high mine. School. I'm still trying to figure out.
I was a late bloomer with that stuff, but in high school and college, like I wish I had the work ethic back then that I ended up developing. Mine came out of necessity, just because like when I was on my own in the 90s trying to write a sports column that people would read, it was like I just had to work harder than everybody else. It was the only way I was going to get seen and read and passed around. So I think once I got in the groove of working that hard, it kind of carried over. Mm-hmm. But I do wish that I'd had that early. Mm-hmm. When do you want to hear my top two Goldie Hawn movies? Do you want that at the tail end of the podcast?
No, I want it right now. Let me guess. Seems Like Old Times.
Oh, is that the consensus one?
What?
Because that's one easily my favorite one. I didn't feel like that was the one she was the most known for.
That's
though.
The one with Chevy Chase.
No, I know. Yeah. That's my favorite one.
It's the greatest. Yeah. That's my.
Okay, so people know that.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. What are your favorites?
Well, I would have thought the biggest one she did, that's not one of the biggest ones.
No, not the biggest. No.
No, no. Seems Like Old Times is the best one.
Oh, it's great with Charles Grodin, Chevy Chase.
Phenomenal.
It's amazing. It's really amazing.
I've been watching a lot of like late 70s, 80s stuff with my kids cuz they've seen every movie now.
Yeah.
So we've been going back to like Just One of the Guys and Secret Admirer and like Can't Buy Me Love.
Wait a minute.
Breakfast Club, all that shit.
Just One of the Guys. That was
phenomenal.
How about when she like takes her top off? I mean, that's some real stuff.
Nudity
that's going on.
Nudity as a plot device.
Oh yeah. It was amazing. Oh, and Can't Buy Me Love. Classic.
Well, the funny thing about those movies is the movies that they love now, the ones that basically Netflix has now mastered this new form of teen movie that they just keep releasing over and over again with mm-hmm. All the Boys I Loved Before, all those, they're all ripped off from the movies that we grew up with.
For sure.
All of them.
For sure.
They're all the same plots, the same kind of love triangles, the same I need a date for the prom and I'm going to ask this guy, we're going to lie to everybody, but we're actually going to fall in love.
Yeah,
it's all in the 80s. It all happened already.
Oh, yeah. Well, now they're making these movies that are really well done, but they're in the kids' genre. There's one my daughter was watching last night. I think it was called Stardust or something like that. And my wife and I, it was on, and we were cooking or whatever, had a glass of wine, and we got into it because it was really well done, very well acted. You know, they're these like young teen sort of movies that are, you know, actually very good now that.
Yeah, there's been genres, right? Like the late 90s, there was horror teen mm-hmm. movies, and it was like 6 years of teens and horror. It starts with Scream, it goes all the way through. So it comes in waves.
Yep.
And I think we're actually in a good wave right now because the Netflix algorithm was studying all the traffic to all their movies. And they're like, wow, people love teen movies.
Yeah.
And they just started making them over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
So now we're in good shape.
And horror. I mean, horror will never die. Thriller horror will never, ever, ever go away. It, you know, for sure. You know how many people are writing quarantine movies right now in every genre? You know?
Oh, my God.
Oh, there's probably quarantine rom-com, quarantine action-adventure, thriller, all of it. You know, all of it. I guarantee these writers who are sitting at home have written, there's a million of these scripts.
Can I give you my best daddy issues movie of all time?
Yeah.
Kramer versus Kramer.
Oh, great. That's what I think Marriage Story wishes it was, personally.
Kramer versus Kramer, better movie. Not arguable.
Oh, without a doubt for me. Kramer versus Kramer, not arguable. That is the movie.
We were just talking about this the other day. I think of all of Dustin Hoffman's movies, and there are 3 million of them, I think his work in that movie, that little kid is fantastic. Obviously, Meryl Streep.
Justin Henry.
But just to see him, and now being a dad myself two times over, to see that and just him trying to make everything work and the playground scene and just being ripped and torn and work and home. And my God, it's got everything you want. And if that doesn't make you just, I'm a puddle at the end of that movie, no matter how many times I've seen it. I'm an easy cry. I cry at America's Got Talent, but yeah, that is one that just crushes me.
That's a great movie. I thought Bills was going to say Big Daddy with Sandler. I thought that was going to be his.
No, that would be a good one, though.
That's a good one.
Well, the other one, the one that's really, really deep daddy issues is Magnolia.
Oh, God.
That goes into some deep-ass dad-son stuff.
Does it ever.
And then Cruz, like, it's almost like the new Affleck movie where he's playing the alcoholic basketball coach, but it's tapping into real-life Affleck stuff. The Cruz stuff in that movie is all starts crossing over because he had a really not great relationship with his dad.
Yeah.
It all comes out in that hospital scene.
Dude,
so
that was
tough one.
I just watched that scene. That's funny you even bring that up. I just watched that scene like two weeks ago. It is gnarly.
The champ. Champ was another one. The champ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Champ!
Wake
up, champ! Wake up, champ!
And he's dead, right? Isn't it John Voight and Ricky Schroeder?
That's right.
And he's dead. Yeah, that's
another
good one. That kind of ends with a thud. That's the thing that I never got as a kid. I loved all the John Hughes movies, but as a kid, I actually really got along well with my mom and got along great with my dad. And I had this kind of, in some ways, idyllic childhood going to all these games and all these different cities. And I'd watch these John Hughes movies where there was so much like angst and miscommunication and just so many tears about parents and kids parents don't understand and all that stuff.
Were you cool with your family? Was it a good one? You know, the back and forth and all that, Bill, or was it like tumultuous?
Oh, mine?
Yeah.
Well, Kramer versus Kramer came out right like when I was living with my dad in Boston. Uh-huh. My mom was in Connecticut, and they used to every other week I would see every other weekend I would see my mom. So they would meet at the halfway point between where my mom lived in Connecticut, where my dad lived in Boston. Mm. And kind of exchange me. And then as I got older, I could take Amtrak and things like that. But it was always pretty cordial. But then by the time I got to college, it was really cordial. They'd both remarried. And they, all four of my parents, would come for my birthdays to go like have dinner. And everyone on my floor thought it was super weird. It was like, Bill's four parents are here. I think they thought it was like, everyone thought it was weird that they got along, but they just kind of did.
And the step parents are cool. Everyone was like big happy family. That's great.
Everyone was all right.
That's great. Yeah. Kurt came into my life when I was about 6 years old, you know, and it saved my life, really. You know, he made me the man that I am today. My dad was around, you know, until I was around 11 or 12. Things were good. You know, the back and forth was really good, and our relationship was solid. And then it just took a fucking hard left. I don't know what happened. I mean, we're in texting communication now. After this crazy situation that went down. When I Instagrammed as a fucking dark joke my sense of humor. It was a picture of myself and my sister in better times with our arms around our father, and it was on Father's Day, and I captioned it "Happy Abandonment Day." And
oh no,
yeah, it was. I thought I was being funny, and then it just
blew up, especially because of my sister and who, you know, her fame. And it took on a life of its own. Long story short, it ended up with us sort of communicating, having lunch, having a few lunches, getting drunk together. And it's created this sort of text relationship right now. So we're,
oh, that's good.
We're trying, you know, we're trying, but it's been better than it's ever been.
Be honest, you know? Oliver, be honest. You were just happy it got you on Entertainment Tonight.
Yeah, kind
of. Did that happen?
Yeah, yeah. I saw it on Entertainment Tonight. Every outlet had Oliver Hudson with this plea for help.
Well, let's be clear. I did not go on Entertainment Tonight to talk about this shit.
Right. They did a segment on it.
No, not at all. You know, but then Kurt came in and you know, brought us to Colorado, you know, taught me how to hunt, taught me how to fish, taught me how to ride motorcycles. And, you know, so my stepdad situation was just crucial for me, you know.
So I, you know, I have a lot of guests on podcasts, a lot of famous people.
Yeah.
And Kurt came on to promote Fast 8 whenever that came out.
Mm.
And it was like 10:30 in the morning at a podcast. And usually people show up and they have like three people with them.
Yeah.
Like they have like their PR person, their whatever. He showed up by himself, which I loved. He looked exactly like I wanted Kurt Russell to look. Like he had like a leather jacket on. He had just smoked a Marlboro Red.
Yeah.
Came in. He was like, what are we talking about? Just did the whole thing for an hour and a half. Yeah. He was such a cool fucking guy.
Yeah.
He left and we were like, wow, Kurt Russell, cool guy. Like that was the immediate reaction.
We talk about authenticity. I mean, there is no one more authentic than Kurt Russell. I mean, hands down. You know, I try to emulate that. You know, we talk about what we try to sort of be of our fathers and maybe things that we don't want to be. He is my stepdad, yes, but he has this true, and you were talking about it about your life, this true not give a shit attitude, which is why he is so successful. He doesn't care what people think about him. And that is the ultimate fucking freedom. And I strive for that every day. Just that attitude of like, you know what? I'm going to go and I'm going to do this scene and I might be fucking horrible, but I'm going to try it the way I want to. And if it sucks, great. We'll do it again. You know, it's just this true sense of self-worth. That is just phenomenal.
And Bill, you know? I know that you had all those back and forths with ESPN. I'm not going to go through all that, but I feel like you're at a free time in your life. You've had tremendous success. You've earned that success. You've built that success. But I feel like you're giving even more and would have a tough time going back under the roof in a corporate structure. I feel like you're willing now to say and be whoever you are that day and that minute.
Well, so we got bought by Spotify like 5 weeks ago.
Congrats, dude, by the way.
One of the things I was really nervous about was being in a giant corporation like that again. But Spotify is just a lot different. In a lot of different ways. The ESPN thing was weird because, you know, and by the way, I was not blameless with some of the stuff that happened, but you just have a lot of middle management and you just have a lot of management period. And the more bosses and people with competing agendas that you have, the dicier it can get for people. I think I never thought I wanted to work for a big company again. And looking at the Spotify thing from every angle, one of the things I liked was like, I knew exactly who the bosses were going to be and what the objective was. And more importantly, the guy who runs Spotify is a genius and it's actually his company and it belongs to him. Whereas ESPN wasn't anybody's company. It belonged to, you know, Disney, but there wasn't one person that ran it. So yeah, I was a little nervous about the thought of working for a company like that again, just because the ESPN experience. But I also think the ESPN experience was pretty different. Even Joe at Fox, like ultimately it's Rupert's company, right? And he was the one that built it and created it. It's his call. ESPN was never really like that. It always belonged to a bunch of different people. So,
well, it's funny you say that though, because when Joe and I were, you know, talking about doing a podcast together, you know, just because we wanted to have a good time and talk about a few things, I was like, well, I don't want to do this with you having to sort of hold back because you do work for Fox. There are certain things that we probably can't say or you can reveal about yourself or really be truly candid,
you know. But Joe says, you know, so far we've talked
it's
about
just, the size. It's just never been that way. And my wife's at ESPN, and I'm thankful for that, and she's happy there, but it's an entirely different company. It is, and that comes from the people that started Fox Sports, who reported directly to Rupert, David Hill, Ed Gorin, and it felt like family. And if you fucked up, and if you did something they didn't like, they'd come right to you. But you handled it, and then I can't even act like we had any issues that way. But you knew they were on your side. They were invested in you, and therefore you became invested in the network. And people don't leave there for a reason, because you feel like everybody's got each other's back.
Do you think you can say anything on this show, anything you want, or are there things that you cannot say?
I think there are things that I wouldn't say no matter who I worked for. I think there are things that some things need to remain just
like
you or your family. Like what?
No, Joe's in a good spot right now, because him, Al Michaels, and Nance, but there's four football networks. So he's fine.
Yeah.
Joe's always going to have a suitor.
That's what I said to him. I was like, you're not going to get fired. You can talk about anything you want.
Joe's great. Joe's in great. I'm buying Joe stock.
Yeah. Yeah, me too, man. Me too.
Well, you just made me buy Spotify, so I'll jump in on that.
Yeah.
All right, good.
Hey, Bill, do you consider yourself a great father?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Yeah.
I think I'm a really good father. I think the biggest thing with being a father is just making sure you're there, even if you're busy. I try to go to all my kids' games, especially my daughter's. She plays club soccer and has a lot of different stuff. And I would always try to fix my schedule to make sure that, I could be there and go to different things that they do. Like they both do music stuff, mm-hmm. and try to be there for the concert, stuff like that. I think that's the kind of stuff you remember. Like I remember, like in sixth grade, I was playing Little League, and I was living with my dad. My dad just couldn't get home until 6:30. I play these Little League games and I have no parents in the stands. Mm. And like, you remember that shit.
Hell yeah.
And I think just kind of being there day after day with your kids. The funny thing now is your kids hit a point where they don't even want to hang out with you anymore. So the corona lockdown has really reinvigorated some parent-child relationships. I feel like I've hung out with my daughter more in the last 3 weeks than I have probably in the 6 months before, because she has no other choice. There's only three other live bodies.
Oh, dude,
available.
Totally. My son is 12, and he's starting to go through puberty. And he's just being...
Yeah.
In these last 2 weeks, he's just being a dick. He's just being...
Oh, yeah.
He's just being a dick. I'm like, well, his name is Wilder. I'm like, what is wrong? What's going on with you, dude? Why are you saying no to everything I'm saying? Why are you being such a dick right now? You know, and by the way,
this sounds like my son.
That's how I talk to my kids, by the way. I talk to them like that. I don't really hold much back.
We do too.
Yeah. I don't. I think we are living in a coddled society right now. I think there's actually a great book called The Coddling of America, because I think that it's a little too touchy-feely for me. It's how do you feel? No, it's not how you feel. You're being a dick right now, and you don't know how you feel. Yes, you have a sense of how you feel, sure, but you need a little bit of sort of discipline at this point in your life, you know. So, you know, I'm in that moment right now with him where he's a great kid and so sweet and loving, but he's going through this fucking thing, you know?
12-year-old boys are dicks.
Yes, yeah, a dick.
My nickname for my son is the biggest dick in the world, because that's what he is. He's just a huge dick. But I do think the coddling thing, I think that's why sports and arts are still so important, because in sports, there is no coddling. You're either going to win or you're going to lose. Mm-hmm. If you're on a team, you're going to play because you're good, or you're not going to play. And that's it. And kids learn how to accept failure. They learn how to accept how to be a good teammate, how to show up week after week for practice and stuff like that. And yep. I think youth sports is more important than it's ever been.
I couldn't agree more, man. I think that our kids are not learning how to fail anymore. It's such a problem. You know, how do you move into the adult place? How do you become an adult? How do you move into your workplace without knowing what it's like to fail?
Well, also parents are afraid that their kids are going to fail, which is a whole other thing. And mm-hmm. Your kids aren't going to learn anything unless they fail a couple times.
Well, I have that fight with my wife now because she's more touchy-feely, and I've already raised two girls, 23 and 20. I've got twin boys that are almost two, and I'm like, look, do you want them to hear no from you or for the first time hear it at school or for the first time hear it? We have got to be willing to say no, mean it, stick to it. You don't get your binky. You don't get this. You don't get, you're going to, I don't care how old you are, structure. And they're constantly pushing. I mean, one of my kids today was being a little asshole. And I had to say, you know, Michelle, just get out of the room. And I had to tell him, no, we're not going to do that. You're going to sit over here. And he's freaking out. But they push, even at a young age. They want to know their boundaries, and it's okay to set them. And it's okay.
But I think they unconsciously, they crave that. They crave the structure. They need the structure.
Yeah.
You know, if they can't vocalize it, they're not cognitive enough. But I think and this is just my own opinion, but I think that kids need that. They want that. They want some sort of structure. Otherwise, they don't know where to go. There's no place to push up against. They have to have that, you know.
You just got to ask, what would Kurt Russell do? And whatever he would do, that's probably the right answer.
Exactly.
It's like Belichick. What would Belichick do? What would Kurt Russell do?
Well, I'll tell you a quick Kurt Russell story that really changed my life, and I think you'll like this. So I was a mama's boy big time. Dad was not in the picture. Mom had boyfriends here and there. I was just, you know, I didn't know who I was, and I was attached to her. I would hear these words when Kurt and my mother got together: independent and dependent. Okay, I didn't know what they meant, but I knew that being independent was better than being dependent. I was probably 6 or 7 at the time. He lived in Colorado. He had a house there since 1977. He took us there, and this is where my life sort of transformed, being in the mountains. We had these ATCs, and we went down to the river, which was about a mile away. And we get down to the river from the house, a mile away from the house, and he just disappears out of thin air. I don't know where the fuck he is. And I am looking around, and I would call him Pa. We didn't call him Dad. We didn't call him Kurt. We call him Pa. And I was like, Pa? Pa, where are you, Pa? Screaming. And I will never forget it. It's that flashbulb memory of, like, you know, I remember what I was looking at. It's so seared into my mind. And he was sitting behind a tree watching me panic and letting me panic. He gave me about 5 minutes of pure sheer panic. He came out, calmed me down. Oliver, Ollie, hey, relax. I'm right here. I got my wits about me, and he goes, I want you to take us home. And I was like, hell no. I need to be behind you so I can see you, so I know that you're not going to leave me, you know? And he convinced me not to get us home. And he was behind me the whole time, and I would look back to make sure he was there. We get home about a mile away. And he goes, see, you got us home here. I was following you, but you know how to get home, you know? If I was gone, if I was truly lost, you can just go home. This fucking light bulb went off in my mind. And it was a transition for me to the point where the next day, my parents were having coffee on the porch that overlooked sort of the driveway. And I flew down the driveway in my own ATC. And I said, Mom, Pa, look, I'm independent. Not really understanding what it meant, just knowing that it was a positive word. And I was off. I took off and I was on my own. I was able to sort of be free because, you know, figuratively and even sort of emotionally, I knew how to get home, you know. So that's a Kurt Russell story. That's how he raised me, you know, and that's how I try to raise my kids, honestly.
Joe, did Ollie just cut the trailer for Daddy Issues?
I think he did, and he also...
that was it, right?
I listened to that entire thing, and as we got to the end, I started getting pissed at my dad. Like, what the what the fuck, Dad? I didn't have any lessons like that. I mean, he could have been eaten by a bear. He could have, you know, whatever, flipped the whatever the hell he was driving around on, ATV, ATC, whatever the hell you called it. And look at you. Now look at you, Oliver Hudson. Look what you've
become. Good one. Hey, Bill, before, do you have any issues with, you know, like, parenting between your wife and you? I mean, like, do you guys do it differently to where there has to be a compromise of sorts?
No, we're pretty aligned.
Yeah.
I mean, She's the LeBron of the family. I'm not even Anthony Davis. I'm probably more like Danny Green. I can hit some corner threes and guard the other team's best perimeter guy. That's about it. So I just kind of fall in line with her. She calls the shots.
She does.
Well, I can say good this. We could not have come up with a better first guest for mm-hmm. our podcast.
Oh, thanks,
and,
Joe Buck.
And, yeah, dude, this is... I'm glad that you and I, Bill Simmons, have, you know, come full circle. Now we're kind of reading out of the same hymnal, singing out of the same hymnal, and I appreciate what you do. And I know more mm-hmm. about you now doing the research, none of which we got into during this podcast. But good on you, man. You've done a hell of a job.
What research? What were you? What were you wanting
see
to
what
talk
I'm?
About?
Do you see what I'm dealing with here, Bill? Going forward, I have packets.
Look,
of
that sounded like some Edward Snowden shit.
Yeah,
you got, dude, Joe. I'm the color man. I'm Romo. I just made $17 million.
Yeah, eighteen.
Sorry.
So the most important part of this podcast is people will now go to see Seems Like Old Times and Kramer versus Kramer. and just one of the guys. If we live with those three, that's
how by the way, what about Foul Play?
You I was going to say, play? How is it not Foul Play? You've got an
that's
albino.
That's a great movie.
No. You've got a little person.
No, that's not number two for
you
me.
You got Dudley Moore. You got
Dudley
Chubby,
Moore. Got, come on.
Yeah.
No, I got Seems Like Old Times 1, and I have Shampoo number 2.
Dude, Shampoo is... That's
Shampoo's amazing. I just movie. Watched Shampoo 2 months ago. That movie is kind of weirdly timeless, and it's a great LA movie.
Yeah.
It's there's very few like awesome LA get to see different parts of the city all in the same movie kind of movies. Mm-hmm. And that's like the perfect one for the mid 70s.
Yeah.
Heaven Can Wait's another good one where it's like Heaven Can Wait has a lot of good LA in it. It's got some good Malibu and that would be that should be your spinoff podcast series, L.A. Scenery Movies.
Dude. He's got enough podcasts, for God's sake.
Yeah. That'd be
He's like you, except it's one-man band. Yeah. You employ people. Yeah. It's just Oliver and then various family members and friends doing podcasts.
It doesn't get better than this. I mean, just talking to people who you're interested in and just fucking no makeup. And, you know, I love it so much. It's fun. It's really fun.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy. We really appreciate it. I have one more question about the dad thing that I think we're going to... Again, you're the guinea pig, but I just wanted to try to ask this question to even all of our guests. But when you look at your father, right?
Yeah.
What is... It's a sort of a two-parter, right? What is that thing that you sort of inherited from him that you are so grateful for? And then what is the thing that you wish you could do without?
Do without?
Yeah.
The thing... The best thing inherited, I would say two, sense of humor and loyalty. Mm-hmm. The one I would do without, he's way more cautious than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So and I've kind of learned to sometimes not listen to that part of my DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm more like my mom in that respect, where my mom's a little crazy.
And do you take that into your parenting with your kids? I mean, are you conscious of how you grew up, or are you just pure feel? You know, or do you look at that and say, I don't want to instill that into my kids?
The big thing I've probably learned as a parent is let your kids be who they are. Don't try to change it, and kind of whichever direction they're going, just kind of reinforce that direction versus trying to change it. Like I think all little boys are pretty weird until they hit about age six. Everybody who's had a little boy until they hit six is always deep down, you're like, wow, is there something wrong with them? What a weirdo. And then they hit like six and a half, seven, and they start to become normal. And I think the best thing, especially with little boys, is like ride it out. They're just going to be weirdos and they're going to do weird things.
Yeah.
And don't hold it against them, and they're going to figure it out eventually. And if they don't figure it out by like age 15, you might have a problem.
Yeah.
I think like you can kind of tell what your kid's going to be like. Like Joe said, he has two 2-year-olds. You kind of know by age two a little bit of what direction each of them are going to know. Mm-hmm. You can tell who the thoughtful one is. You can tell who the crazy one is. Mm-hmm. You can tell who the fearless one is. Whatever traits they end up having when they get older, they're going to be there when they're two. My son was completely fearless at age 1.5. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's just one of those guys who would jump off the deck onto the beach 10 feet down. And
is he like that now still?
Fearless? Yeah. Yeah, he's like that now. So you got to channel that. Now he's trying to get into skateboarding. And
dude, my kids, you know, skateboarding, they're fucking obsessed with skateboarding right now.
Right. So, and I'm scared because he's fearless, but at some point you got to let him do
See,
it.
See, it's so funny. I'm the opposite. My first kid, Wilder, who's the, again, the most, my second kid, his name's Bodie. He's more fearless. My first one, he's got this, he's very, very cautious, but extremely talented, extremely athletic. Never got into organized sports. I didn't want to push him, even though I wanted to. He was a great ball player, great baseball player. And I was like, fuck, dude, just do it. Didn't want to do it. Now he's super cautious. He's skating, but I want to push him more. And I find myself getting angry that he is so cautious because I know what he can accomplish if he just fucking gets over it. But when I analyze myself, I realize that I'm pretty much yelling at myself when I was fucking 12 years old, you know, from a psychological standpoint, because I was pretty much him, you know. So it's crazy. But I wish he could just break out of that a little bit and be a little more.
Yeah, your kid. Yeah. Your kids are half you. I'm positive.
Yeah.
Just take him to a river on an ATV and leave him.
Yeah.
See if he can find his way back to California.
Well, Bill, thank you, man. I really appreciate this.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.